We this year we have.
So it's time to get started. Shall we begin? And if people want to come in, then we'll.
Sounds good.
So when we introduce ourselves.
Sounds good. I'm Dominic McDowell Thomas. I run Cubicle 7 Entertainment.
And I'm Jason Morningstar. I'm a co-founder of Bully Pulpit Games. We're here to talk about the international RPG scene.
There's one very important question we need to ask first.
What's that?
Where are you all from? Who's from America?
Originally?
That's everybody, isn't it?
Originally or now?
Oh, that's difficult, isn't it? Emotional loyalty. Who are we going to offend?
Greece.
Greece. We're not talking about the Greek RPG scene today.
I tell you.
Yeah? Well, that's actually, it's a good point. If you have knowledge about what's going on in a particular country, we'd love it if you'd share it. We can make this a conversation, especially since there's just a few people here. And I think we've sort of divided up the world informally.
I think so. Yeah.
You're in charge of Europe.
Yep.
And I'm in charge of everything else.
Yep.
Which is probably a fair division of labor in terms of role-playing games. So, to clarify, we're talking about analog tabletop role-playing games.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So,
I think one of the good starting point was back with the last sort of official market research that was widely disseminated that Wizards did back in 2000, just to try and get an idea of the number of gamers there were around the world. Came up with a total of about 6 million, and that was 3 million in the States, 3 million everywhere else. So I think that's the first thing to bear in mind, is that generally the scene in other countries, by and large, is a lot smaller than it is here. Certainly convention-wise, with one notable exception, but that's board games as well. Our conventions, we don't have anything like this in the UK, for example.
What's the largest gathering in the UK?
I'd say at the moment it's about 1,800.
Okay.
Yeah, something like that.
I've been to a convention in Brazil recently, 12,000 people.
Oh, awesome.
And I think internationally a lot of conventions end up being game and comic conventions or, a variety of things. So like Lucca in Italy, which is monstrous. It's as big as this, but it's almost all comics. So there's just a tiny sliver of gaming and then a sub-sliver of role-playing in that massive, population.
Mm. I want to go to that one. That was supposed to be beautiful.
It's
Lucca.
Great, yeah.
Yeah, a really gorgeous city.
Yep. And we can also recommend places to go. Go to Lucca, it's good. I don't know that we're going to be able to share information about every place, but I put out feelers and asked sort of my international contacts about what the situation is in the places that they live. So my samples are both biased and based on where people happen to live. So I can tell you a lot about Slovenia, for example. But I can't tell you anything about Slovakia. Well, I can tell you a little bit about Slovakia, just as an example. I know a guy in Thailand, so I learned all about what's happening in Thailand, and I'll share that with you. But not so much about Malaysia, right? Well, let's talk about Europe first.
Yeah, sure. Right, the UK. The UK has a fairly long tradition of role-playing games. They came into the UK when, I don't know if you heard of Ian Livingston and the UK Steve Jackson. They came over to Gen Con, I think it was in the early 70s. It was still very small and just got absolutely inspired by what was going on. They spent a lot of time with Gary and were just completely blown away. They got an agreement with the Proto TSR to have exclusive distribution in the UK, and I think it was Europe at the time. Interesting, it wasn't just straight distribution, because it was so much cheaper to produce the books in the UK and disseminate them from there, that you ended up having UK editions of stuff. The original material that was coming out of Games Workshop, which was the company that they had, you may have heard of them. In the UK, we look back on before Games Workshop went in for global domination of the Warhammer brands. That's looked back as the golden age of the UK gaming scene. I mean, you had, I'm trying to think of some of the unique creatures that came out of Games Workshop. The Githyanki, I think,
right,
that
yeah.
was, which actually it was designed by Charles Stross, who we're now publishing his laundry book, so we're doing the game version of that. So it's really small industry, and everything comes back. Actually, his first break was writing for White Dwarf magazine back in the day. So
something that I think is relevant here to point out, if you look at something like the Githyanki, I think it reflects a uniquely UK sensibility. Mm-hmm. There's a very different feel to the modules that were being published on that side of the Atlantic.
Yeah.
You sort of made the game your own. It was,
yeah.
it was a little different, which is cool.
You know? I think that showed when things like, I'm trying to think of a bit, I mean, the best example I can think of is that first edition of Warhammer Fantasy Roleplay, which is such a dark fantasy game. I mean, it really is quite revolting in places. We do seem to specialise in that. I mean, I think it's kind of that Northern European mindset of sing round the fire and drink because we're all going to die. We know Grendel's on the way.
That's actually a good segue into the Nordic countries.
Yeah, they. Oh, it's crazy.
It is.
I'm always amazed. The no, there's too much swearing in that story. Are we allowed a little bit of cussing?
Scandalous.
Yeah, here's your scandal.
Oh, it's not really a scandal. It's more just I seem to have. Scandinavians seem to look at me as the party person.
Oh, God.
On the Prague Underground, I was accosted by a group of young Swedes who just came up to me and it was, "Where is the fucking party? Take us to the party."
You can't say no.
I know. And that happened then, I think it's in Budapest. It was just everywhere throughout Europe. Scandinavians think that I am the Pied Piper of the party. It's good for my ego anyway.
I suppose. It gets you into a lot of trouble.
Stop deviating off there anyway.
Yes, sir.
The amazing thing is that really hits you with Scandinavia and German as well is that there's the strength of the live action scene. It's absolutely amazing. You've got, I think that it really hit me when we went to Copenhagen and in the middle of Copenhagen there's Tivoli Gardens, which is, it's like a theme park in the middle of the city. And we walked into the middle, there's the central area, and they've got the usual like sheds selling crafts and stuff like that. About a quarter of them were full of live-action role-playing equipment. And this is, you know, in the big family outing centre in the city. It's just, you know, so commonplace. So that was a real eye-opener. And then, I mean, when you move down into Germany, you've got, because D&D didn't make it into Germany for quite a while, so they had the first role-playing game in Germany, Das Schwarze Auge, The Dark Eye. It really just took off, and D&D could never replace it. I mean, I think because it was coming in English, and they had a lot of good material that was really culturally aimed for Germany. To this day, you've got that's still the number one seller. And then for promotional stuff, and twinned into the live action side of things, they've got like these feature films running on their booths of things that they filmed, and it's absolutely amazing.
One anecdote that I thought was really charming about German live-action role-playing, and we're getting off on a little bit of a rabbit trail here, but this is a good story. So there's a huge event, and I don't remember the name of it, but it's many thousands of people come to play, and they divide you into fantasy races by language. So if you speak English, if you choose to speak English at this event, you're a dark elf. goes from there.
Can I add to that?
Oh, yeah.
Well, I live in Iceland. I've been there for many years. And it's quite a lively gaming scene, I think. There's two gatherings a year from about 150 people for a population of 300,000, I think it's a lot.
Mm-hmm.
There's not so much LARPing, perhaps because it's too cold. I don't know any LARPing group, but there's a really strong RPG community there.
I was in Finland in the spring, and that was a topic of conversation. People were like, "What's up with Iceland?" You know, like it's one of the Nordic countries, but we don't know of any LARPers there. We don't know what's going on. So that's good to hear that you guys have a lively tabletop scene.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, let's move down in Europe. What about France and Italy?
On Germany, I'll just about Essen. If you ever get the chance to go to a games convention in Europe, go to Spiel in Essen. I mean, I can't remember exactly how many to get to, but their door is something like 110 to 150,000 people.
Monstrous.
And it's absolutely enormous. And it's predominantly board game and card game. The German gaming culture is that they have a much stronger family gaming culture. So it's very common for, you know, the family sits down and plays a board game on a Sunday afternoon. so you get that sort of thing, and it's just mind blowing. They go, oh, we don't do much role playing here. You know, it's not so much of a role playing. They've got a hall that's, I think, bigger than the one in Origins, if you've been there, and that's like, oh, that's nothing, you know, in the role playing ghetto. But yeah, that'll do me nicely. Actually, that was good fun, and that's the only convention centre I've been able to drive a van into the hall.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Oh, I was very rock and roll.
That's nice.
I thought, should I do a handbrake turn at the end? That's going too far. But yeah, that one's fantastic. And German food, so can't go wrong, really. Yeah, France has a thriving French language role-playing scene. Now, the peculiarities of it are that licensed games go nowhere in France. And I don't know whether that's sort of like a more of an independent streak or wanting to do their own thing, I'm not sure. But the licensed games do badly. It's predominantly medieval fantasy is what they want. I think it's very hard to break horror games. I mean, every country has its own Cthulhu enclave, but France seems to want the medieval stuff. Spain, I think, is a bit more varied. I don't have a lot of information on Spain, actually. I think it's one of those countries where they prefer Spanish language games coming in, because I think with Germany, I get the feedback we get is that they've been bitten quite a few times by poor German translations of English language games.
And operating on our scale, so we're a pretty small scale publisher, the Germans tell us the people who are playing your game are just buying the English edition.
Yeah.
That there's just no percentage in funding a translation for it.
Yeah.
Whereas the Spanish was the opposite. They very much wanted native language materials, and French too.
Yeah.
I would say that was my experience. I've never lived there, but I go there about every year.
Yeah.
And I always hit the comic stores and gaming stores, and there's just the books that are in the English ones just have dust on them. I mean,
you're talking about Spain?
Yeah, in Spain, sorry.
Yeah. It's funny, isn't it?
And Spain also has that Edge Entertainment Group.
Yeah.
It's allied with Fantasy Flight now.
And we partner with them for translation as well.
They have a big game called Anima. Very thick, lots of rules, classes, and things like that.
And that's did it originate in Spain?
I believe so.
Okay. One of the things that has really impressed me, both in France and Italy, and we can talk about Italy in a second, is that there's a pretty strong comic and graphic novel culture there. That also means that they have tons of printers who are very comfortable with producing very high-end materials, so their games tend to look great. That's certainly been my impression. We partnered with an Italian company, and their version of our game is just gorgeous. You know, it's way better than ours. It is. Just because they have I assume because they have this infrastructure that's based on a very casual comics consumption culture that in America, we don't really have anymore. Like, you know, in Italy, you can buy them on the newsstand. It's not unusual to just pick up a copy of Diabolique to take home on the train with you.
We may be off topic a bit, but I think when we started doing translations, it was funny the learning process of how when you're approaching your own game design, having to bear in mind, I mean, especially with more the actual the graphic design and things like that, and how you're constructing the files and stuff like that.
Oh, yeah.
That's an interesting challenge when you start going into that, isn't it?
It is, very much so. Yeah, and the other piece of that is that it was fascinating for me to work with translators, and our game Fiasco is in 6 languages now and will be in a 7th soon, because there are colloquialisms and idioms that you just don't think about, like split-level ranch. That's a very American thing, right? A ranch house, and you have to explain in detail what that is with photos and make it clear, and then they have to find some cultural you know, similarity, something that they can use. Amway was another one that they were like, we don't do that. We don't have Amway, but we have other things sort of like that.
It's one of the things that catch you out as well, because even working with English, sorry, with American artists, and things that, you know, even, you know, we're very, very similar countries, but just like the references we make, I think the art brief was, it's a village, it's just, you know, just an average village with this location, this location, this location, just, you know, an average village, go nuts. And then we got back, you know, very straight roads and intersection. It's like, oh, I can see what's happened here.
8 mile road.
Yeah. Yes. So it's funny how you can get caught out with things. Yeah, Italy is very small role playing market. It's very passionate. Mm.
One thing that's interesting about Italy is they have nonprofit associations that do publishing as well on a small scale. So, like, we partnered with these guys who basically, if they were here, they'd be a 501c3, and they'd publish, you know, small press role playing games. Which is weird, but that's how it works for them, you know, on our scale. I don't know. Do you do Italian editions?
Yes, yeah. We're still fairly new to the translation thing, but with the One Ring was the first sort of mass translation that we did, and that went straight into French, Spanish, Italian, German.
Isn't the author Italian?
Oh, sorry?
Isn't the author of the game Italian, of the One Ring?
The author.
Yes, sorry, yes, Francesco, yeah. Yeah, yeah, he lives in Venice, and we're all very jealous. yeah, so that was the first way, but to be honest, the other way, we've been more translating things back from Septième Cercle, the French company that did the French original versions of Qin, the Warring States, our Mythic China game, Yggdrasil, the new Viking game that we're doing, and Celtia, which is it's kind of like an authentic Arthurian thing. So it's King Arthur, the Welsh warlord. I'm Welsh, so I'm biased.
I want to mention Poland, because I met some guys recently who talked about something that's very interesting that I had never heard of before. The Poles look back to Ruthenia and Sarmatia as a historical touchstone of when the Polish-Lithuanian Commonwealth was in ascendancy, and that was the time when the Poles were real badasses. And so if you're going to role play, you're going to role play Sarmatia, basically. One of the things that developed there is that these guys started LARPing, doing Sarmatian LARPs, which turned into Sarmatian role-playing games and Sarmatian CCGs, all of which intersect. So I haven't been, but apparently at some Polish conventions, you can go and see guys who are LARPing as, you know, nobles from the 17th century, I guess, but they're also playing the card game, that's about being 17th century nobles, and then they're going to go role-play as well. So, like, this weird sort of transmedia thing within deeply geeky culture that's very specific to their sort of national identity, which I don't know. I don't necessarily see that anywhere else.
No.
Isn't that weird?
Yeah.
So go Poland. I thought that was pretty cool.
Yeah, there's a line there you don't want to cross, though, isn't there?
Yeah. There's definitely... Yeah, and that's interesting, too, because there's a...
That's a good point, actually, yeah.
There's a dark piece of nationalism associated with that.
Yeah,
That's a little weird, but...
But, you know, it's a bit like an ice, and people do a lot of Viking role-playing.
Sure, yeah. Reference the sagas is their source material.
And soon the people of Wales will
be able to have their game at last. After so many years. Hey, can we talk about Japan?
Absolutely.
I want to make sure that we talk about Japan, because I'm super excited. Is it okay if we talk about Japan?
No.
Oh, I thought you were like, I don't know.
I'm sorry.
We're talking about American nationalism, what our
what
our
national identity was. I'm like, I don't know.
Cowboys.
It'd be like family stories or something.
Yeah, yes.
The founding fathers or... there's
so you're just waiting for the Abraham Lincoln Vampire Hunter game to be made.
Yeah, exactly.
No, I'm sorry. I wasn't meaning to disparage.
So I know that Mark Causey's here, who knows some stuff about the Japanese RPG scene as well. I talked... Recently, I sort of interviewed Andy Kikowski, who's the guy who runs j-rpg.com, which is a really good resource for this stuff. And he speaks fluent Japanese. He's married to a Japanese woman. He's lived in Japan for years, and is in the process of translating games. So he translated the game called Made, or facilitated the translation of Made, and is about to release a game called Tenra Bansho Zero, which is absolutely bonkers, and quintessentially Japanese in really weird ways. And that's the thing that excites me about the Japanese scene, is that they're doing stuff that is certainly culturally relevant and appropriate to them that kind of blows our minds, because it's very, very different and coming from a very different place. They have a different kind of gaming culture too, in that there are two big companies. Here's the scandal. You guys ready for the scandalous part? Should I just proceed with the scandal? So you've got Fear, Far East Amusement Research, right? And they're producing games like Tenra Bansho Zero. And you've got Group SNE, which is producing other games like Sword World, which is one of the very first native Japanese role-playing games. They are owned by the same Zaibatsu. Yeah. Same Zaibatsu owns both of them, and Square Enix, and a whole bunch of other entertainment entities. So don't tell anybody. That's as scandalous as I think we're going to get. But super weird sort of culture of play in Japan. They don't sell through stores, typically. They sell at Kamiket, which is this giant event. That's like the thing you go to in Japan, right? So there's 300,000 or 400,000 people who descend on Tokyo for games and comics once a year, I think. And there's a total gray market there of fan translations and people who, like, they'll stat up a bunch of Gundam and GURPS, and they'll you know, photocopy that and sell it for $5 to each other, which is, you know, I think quite interesting. Or games that have not been translated yet will get sort of under the table translations into Japanese. And these guys are, this isn't their day job, you know, these are small press, super indie people that on that level are operating. A couple things that are super interesting to me that represent unique technology in role playing that the Japanese have kind of come up with. One of them is the concept of the replay, which is an extended example of play that includes all the social cues among the players. So it reads like a script, essentially. Is that fair, Mark?
Absolutely.
Okay. And the crazy thing about replays is that if you look at a game like Sword World, for example, there's the core rule book on the shelf. We're looking at the shelf here. There's the core rule book. There's some adventures for Sword World, and there's a bunch of replays. And so from a sort of Western point of view, you're like, what's that about? We're going to read about other people playing this game? Why would we do that? And the Japanese answer is, making an adventure is easy. We know how to do that. Anybody can make an adventure. But we want to, you know, we want to learn how to play the game, and we want to see how other people are doing it. Which is super, super interesting, because that's something that I think would be enormously beneficial in our culture of play, to be able to see four people who are really good at a game, having a good time, doing things both socially and procedurally that illustrate to you what a game should look like. And we don't have anything like that, typically. Often we'll have examples of play embedded in our text, or we'll have an example in the back, but nothing as comprehensive as like a book I can give you, you know, that is... Usually they're illustrated, and they include all the side chatter that would be part of a role-playing session.
And they'll even call out, for instance, if the GM is making a mistake. Like, if there's a point where they're playing through and no one really calls them on it, they're like, by the way, this isn't the way the game is written, or something like that. They'll have a call out for it.
That's fantastic.
I'm intrigued by the illustration. Is it sort of like somebody rolling dice, somebody eating pizza?
Well, in the point that was made to me about replays is that it's another method of engagement in the hobby,
mm-hmm.
right? So there are groups, and again, this is that weird gray market at Comic-Con that'll be like, hey, let's make a replay. You're a really good artist. We have an awesome group. Let's record what we do, transcribe it, add art, bind it, and sell it at Comic-Con. And that's a thing that happens.
Right.
And that's something that we have no analog to at all. Like, we'd be like, hey, let's make an adventure for D&D and sell it at Gen Con, would be the closest thing. So totally another way of going. Another point I want to make about Japanese games, and then we'll move on to the world. I'm just excited about Japan right now. So, typically their games have lots of tables in them. And this is a method of reducing analysis paralysis that we're familiar with because we do the same thing. But the Japanese philosophy typically can be defined as roller choice, which means that you're randomizing something, but the choice that results from that randomization isn't hard-coded. So if you look at it and you don't like it, there's a whole list of things that you can choose from that are in that list, and you take the one that makes the most sense or that you like the best. Roller choice. I think we could do a lot more of that here. I think it's a very interesting piece of gaming technology. And it's just a social thing, ultimately, and I think we probably all do it.
Yeah.
But to just say that's how it works is pretty cool.
I've got a couple of points to add before you leave Japan. I know that, so there's maybe two big stores in Japan. That's big being they have a web presence. And I know, for instance, there's one called PlaySpace Hiroshima. And when Andy went to Japan to visit, because I was following the website and I was telling Andy about it, we were using it. It was a very great on website. He walked past it two or three times. No sign. didn't realize it was a store. Basically, there was a door you could walk through, and it was just shelves of books and a guy in the back smoking. And he just maintained his website, and he would tell you what he had for sale. The other thing I wanted to get to is where the Japanese actually role play. So in America, as far as I know, most people play in their homes or their apartments. And in Japan, that's not really where you game. I don't know the cultural reason behind it, but generally you go to, for instance, a popular place is to go to a karaoke club. You get a nearly soundproof room. You can order food and drinks. And you've got a table in front of you. And everyone's got privacy. They can game.
And you're renting that space?
And you rent the space for cheap at that point, because you're not paying for much other than just the song and things like that. You're not singing, so. But the other large store, the Roll and Roll Station, which is in Japan, their store is large enough that they have tables with curtains, and they put this little curtain between you and everybody else in your group and come in and play. And I think there's like a GM reward program that Andy
got into. Yeah, I saw his membership card at Roll and Roll.
And so basically to encourage GMs to show up and run games for other people, there's just like a little punch card for every time that you ran a game. And they were going to get, like when you hit like the end of it, it wasn't something, like in America, you know, you might get a free drink or a free burger. he calculated about $150 worth of merchandise was available to you at that point. Just because you kept coming in and running stuff for other people to keep the business going. So.
Yeah, I think that's a good point about sort of the social dynamics in different places. A friend of mine in Slovenia said something very similar, that there are clubs and that you sort of finance your club and that's where you play. And that's a different model than we have here. In the UK, where do you guys play? I know you play in pubs all the time, right?
All the time.
Right.
I think it's probably predominantly in people's homes. There are games clubs, but there's not as many as there were. And games clubs tend to be more war game focused. I'd say predominantly in people's houses.
I think when I went to Japan, I found if you're entertaining, it's very traditional things that you're doing.
Mm.
You don't entertain to hang out and you're not, you know, serving drinks at your house. You're not doing that kind of thing. You have your traditional dinner. It's all very. It's a different mindset for having people over.
So if you were going to do something like play a role-playing game, it would make a lot of sense to take it outside the home.
All your relaxing social stuff is outside the house.
So where are we on?
I don't know. I know I have a Singapore distributor, but I don't know what. So games are sold in Singapore. that'd be interesting. I'll have to follow up on this, I think.
So my man in Thailand, Chris Sanderson, he runs a store called Battlefield Bangkok, he said that the majority of their products are in English. Esoterrorists has been translated into Thai, and it's somewhat popular. that the people who that Warhammer's big, miniatures games are big. There's a big bias toward 40K among Thai gamers, and I suspect that's largely due to distribution. That that those are the games that are showing up.
Yeah.
And that's the story I kind of heard again and again, that that people are playing D&D and they're playing World of Darkness because they can get them. So the guy in Israel was like, yeah, everybody plays D&D and World of Darkness because that's pretty much what we have. Mm. He said that Shadowrun had a Hebrew edition that nobody bought. So I don't know what's up with that, but that's what he said.
So in Brazil, that's really been a big change in the market in the last 2 years. There's a lot of indie games coming out. Fiasco is out.
Right, it was the Retropunk.
And the Spirit of the Century and a few of the John Wick games. There's a lot of good indie games that are made in Brazil as well coming out.
Mm.
There's a zombie game, there's a, like a space psychological horror game that came out that is doing very well as well. And there's this World RPG Fest every year, and I was there a few months ago, and so, yeah, over 10,000 people with the games. It was great.
I'll have to check that one out.
Did you see Violentina?
Yes. I know the guy who wrote that. It's from my hometown. And that looks great.
Yeah, I'm excited.
I haven't
about
played
that
it yet, but I saw it.
So one of the things I think that sort of, the hoary old cliche is that the world is getting smaller, but in such a niche activity like this, it really is. And so if a guy in Brazil makes something that's incredibly cool, we're going to hear about it. Mm-hmm. And once we hear about it in the English language world, we're going to find a way to get our hands on it and translate it so that we can play it too. And we're starting to see that sort of I think typically there's been a pipeline of games in English being translated, and it's starting to reverse. We're starting to see games that originated in other languages. Certainly, you guys have a line on what's happening in France, and we're seeing that in Italy too. Games that are, native ideas, native games that are then being translated into English, which is very exciting. And Japanese, of course, we're seeing games like Shinobigami is coming at some point. Golden Sky Stories, Rutama, Tenrabancho, Maid, all of which are just bananas. They're just super interesting games. I need to rave one more time about
You go.
We played Rutama, which is a game about walking around, I guess. Is that a fair way to describe it?
I believe the best description I've heard of it is Oregon Trail, the anime world.
Yeah. So we needed to buy a tent, but we couldn't afford a tent. We had to get a bad tent for our trip to the next town, and we had to think about the food we were going to take, and we all got hungry and had tummy aches, and then it sounds ridiculous and it doesn't sound good, but it's an amazing game, and the fact that it focuses on this sort of this almost metaphysical journey that you're taking is deeply satisfying in a really, really strange way. And that's something that I couldn't see it coming out of our design culture. These are people who are thinking about things differently.
Mm-hmm.
If you're a magician in Rutama, one of the first spells, if you're an autumn magician, that you can cast is to create a pile of dead leaves. I think that's great.
Was that it's not the first time that French game had translated, but one of the big change now between the first one, it was in Dominique, when Las Vegas, Dreams of Our Wars, and Nephilim, is that now it's translated with the French feeling, and it's not adapted to English and American market.
Right.
Yeah, I'd heard that the two editions of In Nomine were very, very different.
Yeah. It's very not the same.
So can you speak to the idea of French feeling? I've heard that I have Italian friends who were like, wow, the Italian edition of Trail of Cthulhu just doesn't, it's not Italian. And I don't know what that means, but
wasn't it an element of censorship, I think, with the I think if it was, I can't remember if it was In Nomine or...
In Nomine was censored a lot.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That there was...
Well, in France, you don't censor a game. People will do themselves if they want. People tend to censor themselves, especially in game club. I think 1/3 of the revenue in France is in game club and not home. And what we had a big problem a few years ago about role-playing games and the towns and so on.
Mm.
While it made a move underground for a few times, and it took steps from the underground scene, and now we say, yes, you can do big diamonds that have to. That have to make sex to have progress. Yes, it's good. You can do. You never publish such in the United States, but
yeah.
You can.
I see.
The thing is, it's a market for adult players.
Mm.
And, it's, yes, you have that. That's something. I think it's more on the role play part. You don't really look at how it works, but you look at how you want the game to feel.
Mm.
It's a thing from Shadows of Eternia, or for example, something that you see in interest. Sometimes the game system is not that good. As an example, for example, interesting, the first time you are like, but how does that work?
It works perfectly for the record.
No, it's fine, but when it's translated, there was some multiple game before and so on, so you have the idea how it works. But sometimes it's quite unfixed. You don't have a really, really precise way to tell how the game system works. You have to improvise.
Mm. Yeah, absolutely. I think that's right. I think going into game design as well a bit there, but I would say that as well. You see very strongly themed games from Europe. Definitely starting with the concept and the theme and the mood that you're trying to evoke, deriving some mechanics from that for varying degrees of success, as you say. But you don't see as many ugly role playing books from Europe.
No,
tend to be very pretty.
Well, in France, I think the best that we have now is from the two games. We have the Cthulhu Translation.
Absolutely, they're gorgeous, aren't they? French and German Cthulhu supplements, absolutely wonderful. It's to the point where it's always difficult when you're doing translations back, and it's you've got to weigh up whether it's worth it. But never mind the words, I would pay just for the layout files.
I have a German Cthulhu book. I don't read German, but
they're gorgeous.
Why doesn't that happen more often? Like, why not? Like, if translations are happening, why not get that layout?
Well, we do. It's in our contract. I mean, we learn.
Yeah, you get the package when you license generally.
And you can reuse it for your own, wherever your company is based, that language.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. It tends to be you license for a language based market rather than a strict territory. You just get the rights to sell that language edition.
Or John, is your question about, for example,
repurposing the layout?
Why I'm not using the Italian gorgeous layout in my book?
Yeah.
We actually, it's in our contract that we have the rights to reuse the layout that they created. There are a couple of reasons for that that mostly involve time. We would have to either pay somebody or reconfigure it ourselves for domestic printers because it's done in A5, I guess, instead of 6x9. And so that's potentially a problem. And then there are some other issues related to that. So it's not as simple as just copying and replacing our text with their layout.
But it is an increasingly common phenomenon. And one of the, I think, first big examples, but Dwellers and Barbarians of Lemuria. If you've ever seen the first edition of that game, it's hideous. somebody fell in love with it. I think it was a French edition. It was either French or Italian, and did all new art and turned it into something gorgeous. and they immediately did a new edition using the European art, and suddenly had a really pretty professional looking game.
Yeah, that's happened with Clinton Nixon's games too. Like, because he releases some under Creative Commons, some dude in Spain made a gorgeous version, and you know, that becomes part of the pipeline. I'm not sure that he actually did an English version of that, but anyway.
Along the same vein, do you find, oh, they did it, I wish I did it that way, and the next time you do something, you say, I'm gonna use that idea. I like the way they did that. I'm gonna follow suit.
I've had that experience.
Yeah. The one that I aspire to is the, I can't remember which company is it now, but the their version of it, the Mountains of Madness supplement special edition, came in a crate with a folded flag.
It's the French version, of course.
The French version of Nyarlathotep, the new one, the crater one, come in
10
sign on it.
That's great. That was brilliant, isn't it?
But even something as simple as the Italian edition of Fiasco, they integrated tabs into the layout, which we just hadn't done, and it looks great. And so now we've got tabs, you know, things like that, for sure. I can't tell you anything about Greece, I'm sorry. Do you know anything about the Greek RPG market?
No, nothing.
Not worth it.
Well, that's always lovely.
Actually, that's an interesting point. There are many essentially small languages that just, there's not going to ever be a percentage in translating a game into Slovenian, right? So they're either going to do a fan translation or they're going to play in English. My Slovenian friend said that their language doesn't even have the rigor of vocabulary to do it, so that they'll play in Slovenian and switch back and forth to English. Like, there's only one word for anything that you would hit somebody with that is blunt in Slovenian. It's a hammer, it's a mace, it's a cudgel. That's the word, and that's so it makes more sense if you're playing a fantasy game just to do it in English at that point.
Well, and I knew in Greece, like, if you watch movies there, it's all subtitles. It's rarely do they actually translate it to Greek. Mm-hmm. So it's not rarely dubbed. In a lot of places I've been where they use subtitles mostly, they'd rather just buy the thing in English.
Sure.
Because they're already used to that with all their forms of media.
Yep.
Right.
And you can see that country to country, dubbing versus subtitling.
Yeah. I look at Italy, like, for example, they have mostly dubbing.
Yeah.
In Germany. I think a lot of that's different national feeling about how important the language is. In Italy and in France, the language is important.
The preservation of it.
In Greece, as far as I know, I have some Greek friends that work in the game industry. They have a feeling for their language, but it's very, very costly to make the translation and adaptation. So, they are like, well, we prefer playing English than have a bad one.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Does anyone know anything about Africa?
I asked. I know some South Africans. I asked them. They didn't reply. So I have no idea what's happening there. Other
not sure.
India.
From what I've heard, it's still fairly small. But there is some going. I mean, it's obviously for us there. It's a huge potential market. So it's something we need to find out about. But yeah, no, I don't have much information.
I mean, most of my Indian friends who live there play D&D English edition,
mm-hmm.
And it's considered like it's a way to learn English too.
Oh, see,
like
that's
a lot of people are like, well, if I get to play this game. Like, you know, Drew from Poland, he learned English from
playing
D&D.
Which is, so his English is, that makes a lot of sense. He's always talking about hauberks and glaives.
I all worked out his
There you go, yeah. You know all about celerity.
Yeah.
In India, there is some play, it's very special. We have one customer in our store that work in India and that buy some role-playing games in French or English and fly them back to India, and they use it as a means to learn game concept for video games.
Interesting. Yeah, yeah, that's interesting.
And to use both games and running games for that.
Yeah. That makes perfect sense.
Yes, there is quite a few gaming clubs that make board games and role-playing games in the ETA University in India.
Okay.
What about Russia?
Russia's got a very active gaming culture. There's a lot of LARPing that happens there. There's a lot of translation. Again, sort of native language editions, I think, are more popular there. Do you guys have a Russian translation?
No, no. Well, I think we're starting to get some inquiries. But
but sort of an interesting anecdote about Russia related to live action role play. They take it really seriously, and there's a big community that likes to put on big events. So a Russian LARP may have 3,000 attendees. They'll have they'll do these massive games. They last year they built a city for a LARP that they ran.
And they do it on video games. Like fans of video games will LARP the video game out.
Yep.
Over like four or five days. And there'll be like thousands of people.
Yep, it is a very, very different culture than the way they approach games. It's very intense, very strange. It's strange to us.
As far as like the way that gamers are viewed by non-gamers in the different cultures, you know, it's a really big difference in different countries. Because I know here it isn't a stigma.
Uh-huh.
It kind of depends.
It's getting less so.
It's getting much less stigma. But I know in Israel, last I've known, like, you can't serve in the military if you have a background having played D&D because they did a study that showed people who played role-playing games are unstable. Like, this is an old study.
They can be mind-controlled easier.
Yeah. It's something about...
They've sent in the GMs. Retreat.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, there are huge differences country to country in the way that it's perceived. If you go to Denmark, for example, it is just a thing you do. Right, you can go to Buffer LARP on the weekends, and it's totally socially acceptable. And there are people who make their living facilitating Buffer LARPs there, and there are government grants all over the Nordic countries for all kinds of games.
In Brazil, there was some sort of religious backlash a few years ago.
Sort of a satanic panic kind of thing.
Yeah, and there's still some of that. I know people that used to play in a club and like a shopping mall, and then they had to stop because, you know, the new guy who ran the place was very religious and was against RPG because it's the devil. I think it's, you know, probably similar to what happened to D&D in the early days.
Yeah.
So maybe it's part of growing.
Yeah, but I think the cultural perception varies a lot from place to place.
And it's probably similar in the UK to over here. It's kind of, you're on the low rungs of the geek ladder.
Yeah.
We've recently had a bit more, there's a bit of, geeks are seen as a bit more cool these days, thanks to Big Bang Theory and things like that, but you're still down there. So I'm just trying to think, it has changed a bit. But no, I think, it's still not particularly socially encouraged.
So it is unnerving to go someplace like Denmark or Finland where it's just a thing you do, it's cool, nobody cares. That's refreshing.
Yes.
Like, would you say if you go to Denmark or Finland and you mention it to someone, even if they don't play, they're like, oh, yeah, I have friends.
Totally.
I was explaining to some friends who was coming to Gen Con, like, what's that? And I was like, oh, like, tabletop role thing. They're like, a BDSM thing? I was like, no.
I think the biggest thing that's working in our favor, though, is the mainstreaming of board games.
Yeah, for sure.
I think we're kind of just tag along with those and... Yeah, that seems to be working.
Not so much on computer games.
I think it's still seen as fairly separate. Definitely a link. But in the UK, you get with those figures. That tends to be I think because we've got such a high street presence with Games Workshop, that's the main link in.
But in Iceland a few years ago, there was a Icelandic movie, and I think it's still the most successful Icelandic movie ever. Mm. Everyone has seen it. It was all about tabletop role playing.
That was brilliant.
So everyone knows what it is now. My day job, when I was telling them, I'm going to the US and what is it for? So, you know, like that movie? And then they would know what I'm talking about.
Yeah.
The movie in Icelandic is called Astropia.
Yeah.
I think it's been released in the US as Dogs and Themselves.
Okay.
And it's a fun movie.
Yeah, my friend who's an archaeologist, he goes to Iceland every summer. and he's a gamer. And when he goes, a lot of the people he's working with aren't gamers, but they all know what it is, and he gets them to game.
After they're
done. Yeah, they do 10 hours, and they bust out some dice, and so not a problem.
Right. That movie really increased the interest and the hobby as a general thing.
Yeah.
A lot of people joining the clubs and so on.
But one of the other things that in the UK we had was there was a brief craze of those murder mystery party game things that again, if you have to make the link for people between that and role playing, but that's certainly got more people interested in trying something a bit new.
We have about 5 minutes left, so are there other questions or things people would like to talk about?
China, right?
China. I was waiting for someone to bring that up. I asked. I asked several sort of China. I know a guy who's a China policy expert, and he's also a gamer, Jonathan Walton. And I said, "Hook me up, man. Tell me what's going on in Taiwan and on the mainland and in Hong Kong." And he did not follow through. I'm recording this, Jonathan Walton. You're on the hook. So honestly, I don't know.
There's one of the podcasts, the Jankcast. One of the cast members has to go to China like every other month, something like that. He's pretty hooked in on what's going on in China.
Oh, I wish I'd known. I would have. Yeah.
If I'd known, I would have brought him.
That's cool. Yeah. After we talk, I'm interested genuinely in finding out. Mm. So that would be cool. And in all these places, there's an expat culture of gamers too.
Yeah.
You know, that is not really worth talking about beyond the fact that it influences the people that they're hanging out with that are part of the native culture, I guess.
Mm. What does freeform mean in Australia?
That's a great question. they do things differently. They've appropriated that word in their own way that I don't entirely understand. It's very different from like what we call structured freeform or what Nordic freeform means. Do you have any experience with Australian freeform?
None whatsoever.
So I don't even want to pontificate on it. We'll find some Australians and get them to tell you. There are actually some good resources on the web about it that I've read, but I still don't understand it.
Do you find that depending on the cultures and the people who do historical kind of reenactment will have more of an influence? I know you were saying like Finland, it's acceptable. And I know historical Bronze Age reenactments, huge up.
Okay. I mean, in the UK, it's like warring tribes. I think the historical reenactors think that they don't see that there's many links between what they're doing and what the role players are doing.
And here's American Civil War or World War II reenactors who are essentially playing elaborate games.
Yeah.
And that there's lots of potential for cross pollination, but I don't see it happening yet.
No, there's definitely a barrier between it.
Final question. Final
comment. There's one integral from Australia that is here at the
convention. Mm. Oh, we'd love to meet him.
We ask him his business card.
Good deal. All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you for that applause, John Stavropoulos.
It was a scandalous.
It was, and I'm going to flip this table.
All right.